Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome everyone to Regulating AI, the podcast dedicated to fostering a global conversation on building fair and equitable frameworks for artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are joined by a truly inspiring leader who brings a unique African perspective to the AI regulation table. Dr. Chico Gitto is the founder and CEO of Kahala, a company often referred to as Africa's very own Skunkworks, a hub of innovation focused on driving the continent's digital transformation. Dr. Gitto, with your background in computer science and your expertise in leading digital solutions for Africa, you have some very valuable insights to share with us today. Thank you for joining us on Regulating AI.
Thank you so much, Puri, for having me. I've listened to some of the podcasts that you've had before, very engaging and very thoughtful, provoking conversation. So I'm happy to contribute to that ongoing discourse around AI, especially from an African point of view. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Chico, our listeners are global. We have a lot of members of Congress, US members of Congress, Senate, European MPs, staff, think tank leaders, CEOs of companies, and other AI aficionados will listen to us. So obviously, they'll be very, very interested to hear your perspective. So first, why don't we begin with your journey? Can you tell our listeners about your journey and what inspired you to establish Kahala?
So my journey starts in the middle of Kenya in a small town, now city, called Nakuru. It used to be a village city. Mm-hmm. I mean, village town, but now it's quite grown in the past 2 decades. And I'm your usual African child, not middle income at all. So let's say if any of the big NGOs were taking photos of kids when I was growing up, as they do right now, I'll likely be on the image of one of those pictures because I was brought up in a slum. But I mean, I'm gifted and I'm grateful for that gift, is that I leaned towards mathematics and sciences. So I was really good at that. At least my mom tells me since I was a child, I was always good at that. And that led me to where I am. I used to think, I had a very inspirational maths teacher. She was called Mrs. Lois Coyle. Unfortunately, she passed away a few years back. And she was my maths high school teacher. She truly inspired me to be my best. She would tell me the way you approach mathematics is very different from other people. The way you problem solve is very different from other people. And you know, as a teenager, when you're told things like that, they hype you. And they work on your small teenage ego. And you really want to prove that you're worth this trust from this person. And so when I went to university, I went to a Christian liberal arts university, African Nazarene University. They only had 3 programs at the time I was going to university. They had theology, they had commerce, and they had computer science. And for me, it was an obvious one, because when I went through the curriculum and the course content, maths made up a majority of what I was going to do in my first year at uni, and for me that was just, it was just natural selection towards computer science. And I loved computer science and I loved programming. In my first programming language was in Pascal. I always tell people, most people I've worked with in at Google or Microsoft, they use computing since they were kids. I started touching my first computer when I was at university. And they taught me everything from typing to being able to format your work on an Excel sheet or a Word document. So I started computing literally at university, touched my first computer at university and loved it. I loved the ability of programming and being able to manipulate this machine to do what I wanted to do. And so I fell in love with programming and writing code. And I always tell people, we used to run, quote unquote, run our programs on paper. So because we didn't have enough university computers to go around to everyone. So when you go to a computer lab, you had already written out your code on a piece of paper. You go and type it out. And hopefully there are no bugs, and so that the next person can be able to use the computer. So that's how I started, but it did not stop me. For me, my big, my big aha moment was in my quarter life crisis of when I was 23. I got to go and work very in a similar situation to where I was born, in a slum in Nairobi, and I saw the human suffering. In a mature way, you know, when you're a kid, this is part of your life, so you don't know any other. But when you've been exposed to a different type of life and you come back, you realize, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? How can I make a difference to these people's lives? And that is what has inspired me the rest of my life. So I combine what I love the most. I love mathematics, I love code, I love technology, but I'm very, very realistic that I was born in Africa for a reason, and I apply what I know and my gifting towards elevating human flourishing, increasing human flourishing in Africa, from poverty to thriving. And it's not just a matter of livelihoods or just getting out of poverty, it's increasing hope and thriving. And yeah, that's what inspires me. So after uni, I went on to graduate school at the University of Cape Town. Then I got to work with Google. I got to work with Microsoft. And so I got exposed to work with the best in the world in the engineering team to learn how to build for billions of people. And that, I always say, I sharpened my skills with the very best and my sword with the very best so that I can apply it at home. And that is what inspires me.
Oh, fantastic. What a great story. You love math, you love computers, but you took it upon when you were in a university, unlike a lot of kids who start at 3, 4, 5. But I think what's really inspiring is your mission of taking poverty to prosperity, Shiko. I think that's a fantastic situation. Shiko, the digital landscape in Africa is changing quite rapidly. It's a young population. Tell our listeners who are, in many cases, to be very frank with you, don't know much about what's happening in Africa. What's happening with the world of AI in Africa? Just briefly, if you can update our listeners in terms of what is happening to AI adoption in the continent.
So even before I start talking about AI adoption, let's go back to like technology adoption. So my graduate school, my PhD actually, I explored on how mobile, especially mobile internet, was going to change Africa's landscape. And that was 15 years ago. And when I look back now, all the like hypotheses we have, they've actually come to pass. There's more than 90% mobile connectivity penetration and access on the continent. So connectivity is no longer the problem that we're trying to solve 15 years ago, right? Over 60% of Africans have access to a mobile phone. That means every household has a mobile phone. It might be a basic phone or what you call a feature phone, or something we call a smoocher phone, which is a smart plus feature phone. But there is some sort of connectivity and access of mobile connectivity. So the challenge that is there right now is around smartphone with high capability, where the current penetration is just a little less than 40%. And there are many, many people who are working towards that. So when connectivity is not a problem, it's just now the device part of it, then we are in a good place. We are not just cabling the continent. We can actually make it happen. So for us, then it becomes an opportunity. Because every time somebody speaks about AI, the first thing that comes to their mind is the Oculus headsets or a robot or something quite fancy. But how does AI manifest itself on the continent of Africa is a question that we need to be able to ask and interrogate ourselves. As I mentioned, over 90% mobile phone penetration and access, right? What does that actually translate? It means that mobile money penetration on the continent is quite high. I'm from Kenya, and Kenya is the highest per capita user of digital financial services. Yeah, we beat any other place in the world by miles. Yeah. So if you're able to use mobile money and what you call digital financial services, how does that translate to things like AI? And that's when I'm talking to like policymakers around AI. I say, but we've been using this technology for a long time. And there's like, how do you think they determine how much money they are going to give you as a small loan on your mobile phone? They use AI, they take all your behavior via how many SMSs do you send? How many calls do you send? How much money do you receive? And based on all this data, I'm able to determine that Puri can be able to receive 5,000 Kenyan shillings and they're able to pay it back in 3 months, right? And breaking down AI in a very applicable manner is that when you start seeing reality of what the implication of this technology will be on the continent. So it's no longer about Oculus Plus or Prime or Pro. It's about how am I applying this technology to my everyday life based on the infrastructure that I currently have, right? The second one I always say is, within this week, that's why I'm in DC, we are going to be showcasing one of our platforms around just a caregiver platform for moms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, going back to a bit of numbers, WhatsApp is one of the, I guess, highest used social network per capita. Why? It creates community. It creates the right types of quote unquote privacy. It has all these like communal and community based features that people love and use. So in every WhatsApp group that I am in, somebody's always asking a question. Oh, have you seen this rash on your child? Or have you seen this? How do I get my child to love maths? So all of these questions, right? What if we build something that is able to allow moms to get high quality advice, yeah, on their WhatsApp groups, right? And you build a bot that is part of those conversations and is able to learn. So that's one of the key things that we have learned. Again, not Oculus, not a robot, but something that is very practical. Mm-hmm. And let me bring it even closer home. There is one for every 3,500 doctors. I mean, 3,500 people. There's one doctor for every 3,500 people on the continent of Africa. And that is the good, that's a good number, right? If you go to specialist care, like pathologists, there's 3,000 pathologists for 1.5 billion people on the African continent. So this becomes real now, what AI can do. What if I'm able to take photos of my disease, or if I'm a medic, and I'm a medic here, I don't mean somebody who's going to medical school, it's somebody who's wearing our lab coat behind a counter, is able to take a photos and put them on a group, and they're able to get support from people around the world, or that they're able to get fast diagnosis based on other photos similar to this that have been diagnosed previously. Then it becomes real. So for me, AI becomes practical, not just another hype word, not just another thing that we can talk about. It becomes like a solution provider to Africa's most persistent problem. I always say, for many of the world, every time like I'm traveling, I hear people talk about AI. For them, it is like a nice to have, or it will increase productivity and efficiency. For us, it's a matter of life and death. So one of the conversations I've been having, we are doing this AI and health project. Hopefully we can be able to launch by the end of May. And one of the key things, every time I talk to somebody here in the US, they say, but all the models in the US are like at 80% success rate or accuracy rate. I'm saying you're comparing 80% accuracy rate to no accuracy rate at all. Yeah. So somebody who cannot access a pathologist would rather have their pictures have an 80% accuracy rate because they posted on a bot and the bot is saying, okay, you have 10% likelihood you have cancer. Yeah. Rather than we don't know what's wrong with you, you have a pain, you die, and nobody tells you what's wrong with that. So for me, it is things like that makes, for me, a difference, is that how can we make AI something practical and useful for our continent? It's not just a hype word, it is a reality for us. Yes.
So, Shiko, you raised some incredible points, especially for our listeners. As you said, AI is not an Oculus VR, AR device. It's, in some cases, when you talk to people, you know, as you said, and I've seen it personally, I was in Kenya a few months ago, the digital financial systems are incredible. I'm not sure if it's M-Pesa,
M-Pesa,
or things, it's everywhere. And they have probably been using AI from fraud detection, from the amount of things. Anyway, it's been behind the scenes. But I think what you're talking about is even more relevant when you talk about education. You talked about the WhatsApp groups for moms. You know, one of the big things that everybody, at least in the Western world, is talking about personalized education for children. Because, you know, every child, your preferences, you know, things are different than me in terms of your aptitude for learning is different than mine. But if we are teaching the same things to everybody, and then you're talking about the health opportunities, are the leaders in Africa receptive to your message about this access to healthcare that they can now get, access to education that they can get?
Yes, they are. Yeah. So I'll talk about health and I'll come back and talk about the education part of it, right? So we've been blessed as a team to be able, as we call ourselves, the Skankwak of Africa, to be able to work very closely with some governments across Africa. In fact, during COVID, using an AI type of technology, is we enabled our government to be very proactive in responding to the pandemic. I feel like we were some of the most proactive governments in doing in responding to COVID. Why? Because we use data. We use data and modeling to show where will this disease lead to if we do X, Y, and Z, and giving different scenarios and enabling the government to say, here are four possible scenarios. You choose one. I mean, I am a data scientist. I'm not a policymaker, but here, if you do this, just expect this outcome. And you're always making fun is our very first model. Our very first model was to show where will be the highest morbidity based on COVID. I mean, deaths based on comorbidities across the across the country. And that map until today stands right. The number of deaths that happened in that next 2 years were matching almost point on point, apart from like west part of Kenya, where we had taken HIV as a comorbidity. Everything else worked out. And when you show these numbers to our policymakers, they're actually quite receptive because they realize that we have to use data, we have to use these technologies for actually being proactive in response into disease. So right now we work with like county, like sub-country, we call them county governments, to enable them create their own dashboards, model, look at technology and data specifically to do that, using natural language processing, NLP tools, to be able to respond to things that cannot be responded in normal technology. So, for example, we are building a mental health board with one of the counties. Why? Because mental health is a big problem. Coming back to education, right now in Kenya and a few other countries in East Africa, education has been put to a standstill because of the ongoing floods, right? And what is happening is like kids in private school are still going to school, which means that these kids at the point where they are graduating from high schools, because they all graduate from high school, whether they're from your private school or not of a public school, and you're going to university, you're going to all go to the same university, whether public school, where you came from a public school or private school. What happens is that these kids are always going to be at disadvantage because for 3 weeks, you're not going to school because your school was flooded, and now it's always your school is like a resource center for flood victims, right? So what would happen if I'm able to provide personalized education to these children based on where they are, so they don't have to go back 4 weeks or a year as it happened in COVID? They can continue with where they are based on their own aptitude, and it doesn't have to be anything complex. Again, a small feature phone or a basic phone can be able to do this by taking a quick aptitude test of the child's ability to do X, Y, and Z and continue with it. Is it being done elsewhere in the world? Yes. Can it be done in Africa? Yes, with less complexity. And I have like I'll shout out to a friend of mine, Zeraki, who are doing something very similar. They are personalizing content for kids and schools. Not only what they love, what they're doing is they're looking at it from a school point of view and then from a child's point of view and a parental point of view, and providing this kind of support to the schools and the children and the teachers to be able to do this. So yes, it's happening in a very non-American and British way, but it's happening. And I'm really proud about the way we've gone around looking at this emerging technology to be applicable to our continent based on our own restraints.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm so glad to hear that. But that leads me to another point, Shiko. There has been a lot of, and we have had a lot of guests, especially who come in from non-US countries, where the worry is that AI becomes a Western-dominated English language, Silicon Valley-based. Mm-hmm. Africa is rich with so many languages, cultures, history. I mean, it just is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Tell our listeners, what is happening in terms of retaining the culture and language? Is that happening when you, obviously, education, health, and everything is also very important, but culture is as important, languages are as important as some of these things. So what's going on as far as that is concerned, Shiko?
So we released a paper in February where we're calling it the Force Horse. The four horsemen model to AI, to creating an AI ecosystem. And one of those, let me just walk them through quickly. We had data sets and data structures. We had talent, we had infrastructure, and we had use cases. I was talking in the past few minutes about the use cases that we are using, right? And we still have a challenge around infrastructure. It's going to be expensive. We acknowledge that. In fact, one of the more controversial, but I feel like more proactive approaches that we've been pushing for is everybody's trying to buy a new compute infrastructure in the US. Why don't you give us your secondhand, your five-year-old one? We'll use it because We need some form of infrastructure on the continent to be able to have local researchers working on African problems. And that is the talent and infrastructure is closely linked. But even more closely linked is that the fuel that runs, the foundation that runs any AI ecosystem is the data. And everybody has been talking about data sets and building data sets. But we always are pushing back and say, in Africa, it's not just about data sets. It's also the data systems that go with these data sets, because a single line of words in Africa can mean five different things. I always give this example of my son, who is always in the back when I'm talking about this stuff. His name is Kiama. Kiama means miracle in my language, right? Mm-hmm. Kiama means a club of people in something in another language. Kiama also means the day of judgment in another language. So when somebody is saying Kiama, without understanding the context and the data systems that it's been speaking about, they will always, and a model will always spit out what it's been fed. And usually they'll pick whatever is most used, which is usually not correct, right? So we are pushing for what we are calling data systems, is that our language is quite rich. I always tell people say it's 2,000 African languages, but it's 7,000 sub-languages, right? So that's a lot of languages. But the hope is, and the silver lining in this is that many African countries, they speak at least two languages. So there's a mixed language approach to life, yeah? So in Kenya, we have Sheng. In the West African, they have different types of pidgin. In South Africa, is also in South Africa, they have mixed language. So it's, why don't we build models that are accepting these mixed languages towards our fulfillment of our 2,000 languages? And that's what we are doing. So we are doing in Kenya, we are doing something called a Swahili English model that allows for both Kiswahili and English and some mother tongue languages all in there to be able to have as many people accommodated in this as possible. In doing that, we are also building the data systems around it, knowing that this word can have five different meanings based on the context that it is using it, which is the English language is quite lazy when it comes to doing that. But we cannot afford to be lazy in our context, because then you will be feeding the model the wrong languages. So we are very clear of that. I know in Lelepa and Masakane are doing some language work. I know Mozilla in Africa is also doing some language work. There's lots of work doing because we acknowledge that Africa is a very complex place when it comes to language and context. So you cannot just speak about language without talking about context, what we're calling data systems from us, from our end. So that for us is very important. And there are local scientists, local talent that is committed to doing this. Is that we need to solve the huge elephant in the room, which is called compute, which is quite expensive, but it's something that we are working. We're not allowing that to hold us back. Yeah.
So the big elephant in the room is compute. The other big elephant would be talent. What is Africa doing about creating this expertise and talent because of where you are going is an incredible journey, but that journey can only happen if the right talent is there. Is there some attention being put in Africa for that?
Yes. So 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, we held the very first of its kind, a ministerial roundtable with 21 ministers from across Africa in person. I was very happy with that on the AI ecosystem on the continent. So one of the key things that came out is what is they're calling the Nairobi Declaration is the building of an AI council for ministers of ICTs of the continent, right? That is number one. In there is a very deliberate push towards workforce development for emerging tech and AI especially. And this means that it's a commitment by each of these governments to have a trained pipeline of AI talent. And AI talent does not mean machine learning engineers only, yeah? It means the young people who are doing data collection and annotation, as well as data scientists who are cleaning up the data and making it usable and useful, right? And then all, and of course, the male engineers. So there's a very deliberate effort from the very top, from across the country. So it's not just a country by country effort, is we are working together towards this workforce development for emerging tech in Africa. So I'm very happy with that work. It's progressing. I managing many countries is hard, but it's happening. There's already momentum across the continent to doing this. So workforce development is one of those things. The second part of it is working with Africa diaspora, who are already in this space, yeah. And I'm really excited about this work because having worked out of home and having met Africa diaspora across the globe, literally, we have very gifted talent. We are running many of these multinationals. Is how do we tap into this talent to make sure that they are doing that? So I'm allowed to talk about something we are working on yet, but there's something we are working on with African diasporas in the US, to just try and build again a pipeline of talent back home, and also them giving back home in a sort of not just sending cash, but also sending part of their intelligence back home. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. So emphasis on ICT ministers in Africa on workforce, and there is a diaspora effort that is going on. So that's great to hear because, as you said, compute is very important, which you're working on, but talent workforce is as important. Chico, let's just talk about a little bit about AI regulations. The African Union came out with a draft AI regulation draft document, and you were you said that let's first focus on prioritizing AI development before we get into regulation. So can you just elaborate a little bit about the draft, just briefly, and why you think you need to Africa to focus more on AI development before getting too much into regulation?
So what happens in Africa is that most of the time is somebody will come up with an AI document, a policy document, a regulatory document, without fully understanding the context that this and the implication that this document will have down the line. What you're saying for AI is it's such a strategic and important technology that if we start regulating it at this point, we'll never be fully, never fully understand what you have done for us as a continent, right? And what is happening right now is the people who are builders are building, and then the people who work on regulation are working on regulation. There is no conversation or cross-pollination of information between these. So what happens is one day you wake up and somebody has put together a document that really has a huge implication on what you're doing. Yeah. And that's why our team, we have builders, we are continuously building, we're building stuff. On the other hand, we are pushing for non-regulation, but guardrails. Yeah, we are not saying don't put guardrails. We're saying don't regulate, don't put things in place that you don't understand. And for us, we're always going back to M-Pesa. And our then Minister of Finance decided not to regulate. He said, let's see where it goes. And then when we have seen it where it goes, then we will be able to find ways and places to regulate. And that has worked. M-Pesa is not fully regulated up to this point. Why? Because we are constantly innovating around it. And that is the same stance we should be taking with AI, is we don't know where this technology is taking us. We don't know where it's going. What we need to do is put measures in place to protect human dignity and human lives. But on the other hand, allow for innovation to go and be built. And that is the argument. So, for example, the AI framework by the AU is pretty much saying, okay, let's put some regulations down the line, but let's put some guardrails right now, which I totally agree, right? Because we need to focus on what time will we focus on workforce development if we are busy trying to regulate. We don't know what workforce we should be developing. We're not very even fully understand what is the kind of workforce we should be doing, we should be developing. Let's focus on developing the workforce. Let's focus on putting the infrastructure in place. Let's focus on getting, getting our data sets, which we don't even know the extent of how our data sets is going to be even collected and stored and organized. Let's not preempt. Let's just do it fast, and we'll find ways where people can take advantage. Let's learn from the world. Let's have an observing posture without killing our innovation. That is my take. Yeah.
So you said basically that let's let innovation flow, and then we'll figure out the regulation, just like you've done with M-Pesa with the digital payment infrastructure. Yeah. Is there any thought of collaboration? I mean, the EU has at least come out with the EU AI Act. There has to be some harmonization that happens, because today companies are global. They work in Europe, they work in Africa, they work in North America, they work in Asia. And if we have this patchwork of laws, which it seems like we're going to have, and China is going to do its own thing. What are your thoughts in terms of international collaboration on regulation?
So in terms of international collaboration, I think there needs to be, in the same way we have SDGs and operational principles, there needs to be a principles that we are all working from, yeah? Mm-hmm. But we also need to understand that each of the, why are people regulating? I always say people regulate out of their need for sovereignty and out of the need for creating profits, right? Making money. So if it's not making you money, it's protecting your sovereignty as a country, right? So while we have some guiding principle at a global level, I'd say that's the collaboration that needs to go into, like, these are the key principles that we should be working towards as a country, as a region, even as a company, right? Mm-hmm. But also we need to be able to understand our own context and regulate and build regulation from our own context, or not regulate from our own context. Because the moment we all bulk ourselves up into one single whole, then you'll force everybody to adapt into this. And we've seen it with GDPR, right? And the data protection. We have seen what has happened, because we all copied the European version of it. It becomes really hard even to work with other parts of the world, right? We've seen companies literally scrapping themselves from, or are putting themselves from one part of the world to the other, because they can't meet those stringent requirements from one part of the world is how do we make the world as diverse as possible, but also protecting our humanity and our dignity as humanity, but also the sovereignty of the different states. That is how I'd approach it.
Oh, that's so what you're saying is protect the sovereignty of different states. How about sovereignty of data? There is a concern that, you know, African data being concentrated outside the continent. How can AI regulation address issues of data sovereignty and privacy within Africa?
Hence, I mean, that's what I was talking about. The sovereignty is about data, data sovereignty, because right now everybody defines what data sovereignty looks like for them and for us. And you're like, right now we are still struggling what sovereignty means for us, because everybody's saying, oh, put everything on the cloud, you don't have enough money to do this. Our cabling, I always give this example, is that when half of the continent was offline because the cables of the West African coast were cut off, we are still very dependent on other entities for our own sovereignty, and that needs to be protected. Hence why we cannot say we are going to have all be ramped up into one single regulatory framework, because then we lose that. We lose the one leveraging power we have on the continent at the moment, and that's our data. A, because mostly it does not exist in a transferable, shareable manner. But what happens when it is in that state? What will we do? Yeah, how do we transfer that? And that is the question that we should be asking ourselves. And that's what we should be protecting, because we still have a bargaining chip on our end, and we need to protect that. Yes.
Yeah, protect the bargaining chip. Shiko, one of the concerns that I hear from guests, even members of Congress and Senate, and I want your thoughts, is AI is moving so rapidly. Every day there's something new, multimodal agents, this, that, RAG, etc. How can AI regulation keep up with these changes? I mean, put a regulation and then something new, AGI comes in, etc. How does one do that?
So AI will not keep up with technology. I mean, regulation will not keep up with innovation. It has never done. It if we try to do this with the first time in history, it cannot happen. What we need to do is build very lucid frameworks and principles that are protecting very fundamental things. Yeah, like the Bill of Rights, like the right to be human, the right to be alive. Yeah. The right to talk to somebody else and communicate, yeah? And if anything implicates on that, then we go back to, like, okay, what needs to change, right? Regulation shall never catch up with innovation and exchange this space of AI, because every time we think we have gotten somewhere, somebody else comes up with something that throws everything out of the window, and we have to start from scratch. Hence, our argument is that stop pushing for regulation, push for frameworks that protects the humanity, our humanness, but allows us to be able to flourish and build. Yeah.
So, focus on frameworks and, you know, the Bill of Rights, fundamental Bill of Rights. Shiko, what is the thought in Africa about open source, closed source? We have a big debate, at least in the US, about that. How is that playing out in the rest of the world?
So, funny thing is, like, just this morning, this morning in Kenya time, right, we had this discussion. So we have some models. I'm very passionate about being able to be catalytic, right? Is when you build something, allow other people to build on top of it so that you can have much bigger impact. Because if I try and do it by myself, we'll never be able to have the impact. But if other people can be able to build on top of it, they're able to have much more impact. And that is pretty much what open source is after. However, on the other hand, there are people who are saying that even if we open source, the big tech is going to take it and go and make money, lots of money, and become profitable. How do we benefit from this? And for us is, how do you become smart around how you're going to open source some of these things to have the highest impact, but also to make sure that your common Creative Commons license also has an implication on whatever thing even big tech will ever build on top of this. It's being very smart around it. So yes, the argument is still there, especially around data and data sets. in Africa, and how do we utilize and build models that, yes, we are protecting ourselves, but somebody's not going to be extremely rich by taking what we've built and building things on top of it. I mean, honestly, if we were all like nice human beings, we are trying to build the world and make it a better place for everyone, open source will be the way. But we know that we live in a crude and cruel world, and somebody's going to be try and make as much money as possible from the open sourced work. And so it's just an argument and balance towards what do you do as a person or a community or an organization to have the highest impact? Yeah.
Well, that's great. Shiko, when you look to the future, what is your vision for a responsible and inclusive AI ecosystem in Africa?
I mean, it goes back to what I've just said. It goes back to we need to look at AI as an enabling technology to mm-hmm. human flourishing, right? And yes, there are going to be some evil pockets of it, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, my vision of the future is where a service that I could not access, I can access at a fraction of the cost and at a fraction of the time, because this technology has enabled me to do this. And the underlying technology and foundation technologies and has already been put in place. That is my phone, my connectivity is in place, my devices are in place, my data is in place, and I'm able to just access these things because I'm just human and I have the right as everybody else in the world to flourish. And that for me is my vision of the future when it comes to technology. Yeah.
So allowing humans to flourish. Shiko, just a question. Mobile technology allowed Africa and a lot of other parts of the world to just jump through an entire cycle of technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you look at the digital payment adoption in Africa and some other parts of that world, it's much higher than in Western countries. I mean, you know, people there don't think twice about swiping even for the smallest item. Do you think AI has that potential to cause that big jump for Africa? You talked about health and education, but I'm sure there are many others. Do you think this is Africa's movement to take that big jump?
Yes, it is Africa's moment to take that leap. And it's just not leap. It's leaping in faith that you will land well, but also leaping in practicality of access to this indefinite amount of knowledge and resources that you never have accessed before. Yeah. And for me, it goes back to things that somebody said, I think is Sundar from Google, who say that AI is the best representation of humanness and humanity because it's been created by human knowledge. This human knowledge has not been accessible to Africa. Why? Because people had put artificial boundaries to what Africa can and cannot do.
Right.
Right now with my ChatGPT, I can produce some of the best papers. Why? Because I'm no longer stopped by a firewall, a paywall somewhere to access something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The same way with like medical advice, with all these things. Yeah. If you're consolidating human knowledge, we're able to access it in Africa without artificial walls that had been put for Africans not to access these things because you're just in the African continent. Yeah. On the other hand, Africa is now able to influence the rest of the world because we have knowledge they don't have. Yeah. And you're able to actually allow people to understand who we are as Africa from our point of view.
Oh, that's fantastic. So this is Africa's moment. Shiko, you have entrepreneurs listening. You have lawmakers listening. This is your opportunity at the end to kind of, what is a message you want them, because as I said, a lot of them don't know about Africa, but this is my belief, as I said, that this could be a moment to, as you said, make that leap. What is a message that you would like to convey to our listeners, entrepreneurs, lawmakers, think tanks, etc., as to what's happening in Africa and how they can partner with Africa towards this?
So Africa showed the world how to use the mobile phone literally, yeah, in its fullness, right? We have shown the world how to use digital financial services, mobile money to be more specific. And we are going to show the world how AI can actually improve people's lives. It's no longer for us a matter of productivity or efficiency. It's a matter of necessity. and we are going to do it. Don't be left behind in this journey.
Well, Shiko, as we wrap up another enlightening episode of Regulating AI, I want to really thank you tremendously for sharing your expertise and perspectives, really from your groundbreaking work at Kala to your contributions in shaping AI regulation and digital in the African Union. You really, you know, exemplify the pivotal role of diverse voices in driving fair and equitable AI regulation. As we navigate the complexities of this rapidly evolving field, let's continue this meaningful dialogue, and we'd love to have you back again. There were so many other things I wanted to ask, but maybe we'll keep that for next time. Until then, we want to stay informed, stay engaged, stay inspired. Shiko, this has been fantastic. Thanks for taking the time with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you so much again for the conversations that you've started.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.